From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The historian Holger Hook says it's surprising that for all the blood spilled during the Revolutionary War, the story told about it is so strangely bloodless. It was a war. Of course it was violent. There was torture and rape and all kinds of war crimes. It was ugly in ways we just don't remember because Hook says a lot of that has been scrubbed clean. We've been left with an overly sentimental portrait. There are good reasons for this, but if you're really going to understand the American Revolution, you've got to be honest about the brutal parts of the birth of the nation. In a new book, Hook does his part to write the violence back into the story. Today in the program, he's joining us. His book is called Scars of Independence. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Try to imagine traveling the countryside of the original American colonies in those days and months after the War for Independence had ended. You would have seen smoldering buildings and decimated townships, dead bodies, traumatized survivors. These are what Holger Hook is referring to in the title of his book, The Scars of Independence. Hook says violence and the experience of violence were central to the project of creating this new nation. In fact, he says it shaped the outcome. The British could be brutal and cruel, but so could we. Today in the program, Hook is joining us to talk about America's violent birth. He's an historian at the University of Pittsburgh. He joined us from public radio station WQED in Pittsburgh. Well, let's begin with a question put to you by an immigration official when you entered the country, when you came to do some research. And you were explaining this project to him, and he asked you something along the lines of, why would a German specialist in British history write a book about the American Revolution? What was your answer, and what is it now?
My answer was that British historians still tend to study the American Revolution primarily from their own perspective and from British sources, calling it the American Rebellion. Their American and Americanist colleagues tend to study the American Revolution primarily as the founding narrative of their nation and spend less time with British sources. Neither side spends much time with sources that reveal the participation of other parties, especially the German, the so-called Hessian auxiliaries. And so the immigration official and I eventually agreed that this was a worthwhile attempt to try and overcome any partisan, let alone nation-centered or nationalist accounts of the American Revolution, and instead to for me to try and present as even-handed an account as possible, looking at the American Revolution and the War of Independence from the perspective of all sides involved.
You write about how you first started thinking about this when you came across these monuments. They're in England. When you were in England, to loyalists to the British Crown and the American colonies, and how they had stayed loyal.
That's right. That's almost a decade ago now. I was writing a book about art in 18th century Britain and the British Empire, and I kept stumbling, sometimes quite literally, over those monuments in churches and cathedrals and minsters across England. And they all told similar stories of American loyalists who were dispossessed, hunted down, driven into exile for opposing the American Revolution. And I finished that earlier book, but those harrowing stories of persecution, of violent treatment, had stayed with me. And so I looked further into the background to these monuments. I read in American, British, and other sources. And what jumped out at me were two things. One, the sheer scale and pervasiveness of the violence of the Revolution and the Revolutionary War that impacted combatants, captives, and civilians on all sides. And second, the fact that participants on all sides tried to make sense of their revolutionary experiences in terms of that violence.
Yeah.
And so I thought, I became curious. What might a history of the revolution look like put the violence center stage?
Give us a sense just how violent, how destructive was this war? Because you point out, aside from the Civil War, it's probably the most we've encountered in this country.
In terms of casualties per capita, you're right. In terms of the mortality rates amongst American prisoner populations, this is by far the most deadly conflict in American history to date. Even the Korean War in the early 1950s produced a lower mortality rate amongst American prisoners of war. That's the sad runner-up in that statistic. We often still think about the American Revolution as a relatively orderly, relatively non-violent event defended in a rather quaint, almost bloodless war. The revolution and the war fought to defend it was not just, you know, a heroic struggle for noble ideals. It was America's first civil war. It split British Americans and set them against each other. It was a civil war in the British Empire, and it affected the free, the enslaved, the indigenous across the former 13 British colonies.
As you point out, one in 40 Americans at the end of the Revolutionary War had to go into permanent exile. These were the loyalists. And this is remarkable. You say that is the equivalent of some 7.5 million people today who, after the war, had to go off into exile. So explain what in those early days, as the war is beginning to take hold, how are we divvying up sides in the American colonies? This surprised me a bit. I guess I should have known this.
So John Adams got it roughly right. He said, well, after the war, about one-third of those white Americans living in the 13 British colonies that started to separate from the British Empire, about one-third were in favor of the revolution and of American independence, ultimately. About fully one-third were opposed to independence and preferred instead to stay within the British Empire. And a final third tried to stay neutral and sometimes managed and often failed and were forced to take sides. So we're talking, that's why we're talking about America's first civil war. And the loyalists, those who wished to stay within the British Empire, were not just your stereotypical, you know, white Anglican elites. Loyalism cut right across every social class, religious denomination, geographical location, and indeed race. So you have African-American loyalists and you have Native American nations splitting as well. The notion of a non-violent and orderly revolution breaks down the moment you dive deeper into the sources. It's true. It's often said there's no guillotine in the American Revolution, as there would be, you know, 20 years later in the French. That's true. But violence was not the regrettable exception to an otherwise orderly revolution. Violence was a defining, it was a necessary element. The revolutionaries, the patriots, needed terror and violence to suppress their domestic enemy, the loyalists. And so if you made it clear through a wrong word in the wrong company, or by toasting the king, or by singing the wrong song in the wrong tavern, that you were not with the patriots, you risked being branded as being against them. You might be interviewed, your mail might be intercepted, your house, your business premises searched. You might be abused verbally, certainly, but also physically. Yeah. You might undergo torture. So there's the 13-year-old, the teenage loyalist Walter Bates, about 16 years old, of Darien, Connecticut, who is arrested by a patriot gang for supposedly having information about the whereabouts of his fugitive, also loyalist brother, and the brother's friends. And Walter undergoes various forms of torture at the hands of his patriot captors. Water torture. At one point, he is tied to a log and threatened to be cut in two by the saw in a sawmill. If you are a priest refusing to stop praying for what you consider your legitimate king, you might be dodging bullets fired at you mid-sermon. women assisting the British army by ferrying intelligence or goods or helping loyalist refugees find security within British lines were abused. Newspapers, loyalist newspapers, pamphleteers, printing houses were the subject of attacks. And so once we get to the hot war, if you want, the war between the armies, there are about 19,000 loyalist soldiers enrolling and fighting in loyalist units alongside the British Army.
Let's talk about John Malcolm. He's a 51-year-old customs official, nothing special, really, as you point out. Lives in Boston. He was a loyalist, a Tory. And he, as you lay out in really brutal detail, is tarred and feathered by a patriot gang. Would you just talk about this, what it's like to be tarred and feathered?
Tarring and feathering was a not uncommon form of punishing, of naming, shaming, and brutally physically punishing dissidents. By the time of the revolution, those were the loyalists or their British officials on the way out, often tarring and feathering occurring on the waterfront on the East Coast, partly for the availability of the necessary materials. A victim would be usually stripped of some or all of their clothes. They would have hot tar applied to their torso, sometimes also to their head, and then feathers from cushions or any other nearby supply sprinkled on top. Usually the ritual of punishment is performed certainly in public spaces. It might involve a procession along the waterfront or through different parts of a town. The case you're mentioning, John Malcolm, various points in historic Boston. And at the end, if a victim was lucky to survive still consciously, they might be thrown into the water or they might just be dumped in front of their house and then undergo a painful long period of recovery, often using turpentine to remove the tar from their body, usually scraping parts of their skin off with that and revealing open flesh wounds.
This Malcolm story is so brutal. He was whipped during during all of this, taken to the Liberty Tree. This is a large elm tree at the corner of a street there. He was asked to condemn the governor. They threw a rope around his neck saying he was going to be, threatened to hang him. I mean, this must have been absolutely terrifying. They threatened to cut his ears off if he didn't curse the king, which he refused to do, by the way, at least at first. Finally, he gives in. I mean, it became too much. They made him swallow large quantities of tea. They wanted him to toast the king and other members of the royal family. Obviously, they were mocking him. I mean, he does survive, but it is just an awful ordeal.
It is. He survives. He recovers. And the following year, he packs up some of the scrapes of skin with a tar on it that he had scraped off his body and travels to London. And then he sends pieces of that skin to various high-ranking government officials, members of parliament, and he even is presented to the king. He ends up being given a minor pension and a quasi-military appointment, never returns to America to see his wife or many children. Mm.
What do the British make of all of this? You talk about King George and his dilemma. He sees his subjects in the colonies as children, and for a while he tries to accommodate them, but eventually toughens up, starts to see this rebellion as an insurgency. And you call this a strategic moral dilemma for British leaders because they have to figure out what the difference is between waging a war with a legitimate enemy where you follow the proper protocols and the rules of engagement, those kinds of things, and what you do, how you treat a rebellion. Talk about that dilemma, if you would.
Yes. So the American Revolution is probably the most divisive political issue in 18th century Britain. It divides the political leadership, divides the army, it divides the literate public. And at the heart of this is the question of identity. Who really were the Americans by, 1770? They were both very similar to and very different from mainland Britons. They were tied by the same language, similar religion, common heritage of political rights, affiliation way into 1775 to the crown and the monarchy and a flourishing trade. On the other hand, from a British perspective, the Americans' Britishness, their British identity, the British part of their identity, had been diluted, if you want, by large-scale immigration, by the transportation of large numbers of convicts from the British Isles, of course, by the presence of 500,000 African slaves. But whether you were, whether you emphasized the similarities or the differences, the conflict that was emerging was really a civil war amongst fellow subjects. It divides, as I said, the leadership as well as the public. Hardliners say this is a rebellion just like any other we have seen in the past in the British Isles or elsewhere in the British Empire, and it must be quashed with any force necessary. At the other end of the spectrum are moderates who say, let's seek political reconciliation as far as possible. And then somewhere in the middle, you have those who say, well, it may require some force, just enough to bring the rebellious children, colonial renegades, back to the negotiating table. But once the king declares the rebels to be in the American patriots, to be in open and avowed rebellion, there is no going back. And so then the decision is, as you rightly point out, do we treat this as now a legitimate enemy, the way we would treat a European power like the French, our arch enemy, or the Spanish or the Dutch? Or are these rebels and to be treated, therefore, the way rebels have been treated by the British Crown and their forces in the past? This is a time when codes of war, conventions of war, are clearly established by the forerunners of international lawyers. The codes of war are well known to army leaders, to political leaders. Rebels do not qualify for protections under these conventions of war. So we're talking about rules such as the minimal standards for the treatment of prisoners of war, the right of a surrendering enemy soldier to be granted quarter, and so on. Rebels, strictly speaking, in law, do not qualify for these protections.
I just want to underline the rules for prisoners in the conventions of war, because they were quite generous. I was kind of taken by this. Captive soldiers were to be fed, of course, and to be housed, but cared for like one's own armed forces. Captured officers were sometimes released or allowed to move freely. I mean, they were fairly generous. Those were the rules. But for rebels, I guess those rules wouldn't necessarily apply.
Yeah, a trained soldier is a very valuable commodity to be exchanged for enemy soldiers, if at all possible, and that's how these rules come about. And it is usually the state of the captives who have to provide some of the supplies and the clothes to be sent to the prison camps of the enemy holding their own soldiers. The idea is in wars between European nations, that ultimately you work towards large-scale exchanges. They're called cartels. And there is a system whereby you count one officer of this rank is worth so many more minor officers, is worth so many more ordinary soldiers. But these conventions and the exchanges, the cartels, they imply the recognition of your enemy as a sovereign, an equal sovereign power. And so the British Crown, of course, can't accept that. And so it never comes to large-scale exchanges. They do some smaller-scale local exchanges without invoking the name of the king, sort of half under the radar. But it forces both sides to deal with large prisoner populations in their hands, to be held and, as you say, housed, fed, more or less well, and often less well, on U.S. territory, on American territory, on prison ships offshore, and also in prison camps on the English South Coast.
Let's talk a little bit about those prison ships, for example. The Patriots, of course, portrayed the British as intentionally cruel to American prisoners. And there certainly was psychological abuse. You tell of one group of Hessian soldiers mock hanging a Patriot soldier. They went through that experience three times. It sounds dreadful. But you say the psychological impact of being held on these ships, and maybe you should explain how these prison ships worked. It was as stark, you say, the psychological impact as the physical suffering was.
Mm-hmm. The British deal with the dilemma of holding very limited territory throughout the war. There's the main garrison city of New York. There are, at various times, smaller garrison cities in the south, like Charleston, South Carolina, and Savannah, Georgia. And then there is moving territory. But they have to keep very large numbers of prisoners within limited space, crowded into prison camps, onto prison ships. And wherever you crowd a population, you facilitate the spreading of contagious diseases. It is a challenge for the British to supply adequate rations, both in quality and quantity. Medical supplies, medical care, hygiene are very low. And so the worst impact occurs on these prison ships that you mention. Half of them are off New York, Wallabout Bay of Brooklyn. The other half are spread in different areas of the Carolinas and also in the Caribbean. They are former, now decommissioned, warships, transport ships with minimal but sufficient British and Loyalist guards on them. For most of the day, the prisoner population is kept below decks and in mostly dark conditions with very limited supplies of low quality, no frequent changes of clothes, very limited abilities to wash, therefore with the bad hygienic conditions, ideal conditions for all kinds of contagious diseases from typhoid to dysentery and smallpox, of course, to spread. All of this compounded, as you say, by the psychological impact of not knowing how long one might be down there. Are the officers negotiating an exchange? Might I be released in the next exchange? Are we here for the duration of the war? How long will the war last? And then every morning, the British guards will shout, "Bring up your dead." And the prisoners look who has not survived the night and bring them to deck for very primitive mass burials on shore. The mortality rates we spoke about earlier result largely from these prison ships. In some summers, when the climate makes for even worse spreading of these contagious diseases, producing 50, 60, 70% mortality rates amongst these prisoner populations.
Between 16,500 and 19,000 American prisoners are estimated to have died in British captivity, which is astounding. But compare that to those who were killed in action, between 7 and 8,000, or those who died of their wounds eventually, 10,000. I mean, almost as many, or probably more, died in captivity, I suppose, during the war.
It's impossible to be absolutely precise about any of these numbers, but the best estimates we can make suggest that about half of Patriots under arms who died in the American Revolution died as a result of their captivity in British hands. The Patriot narrative is, of course, that is deliberate. Yeah. That this is systematically engineered, or it's the result of some flaw of national character. But if you look at the conditions under which the British, and this is unprecedented because there are none of these exchanges, because the territory in which they hold these prisoners is so limited, there certainly are no orders for the systematic decimation of prisoner populations.
That's Holger Hoek. His book is Scars of Independence, America's Violent Birth. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the historian Holger Hook is joining us to talk about his book called Scars of Independence, where he tries to write the violence back into the story of the American Revolution. I want to be careful not to just highlight British war atrocities. It went both ways, as the book is clearly about. How did American patriot soldiers treat their prisoners? You mentioned how George Washington was quite careful, or wanted to be quite careful about following the rules of engagement, the European rules of engagement. But did it always work that way?
You're right to start with George Washington.
Yeah.
The commander-in-chief of the Continental Army sets an example that his army, representing his new nation, must fight by the codes of war. They must out-Europeanize, if you want, the British. And the treatment of prisoners of war is his first example. This partly ties back to his personal history. In the previous war, the Seven Years' War, sometimes still called the French and Indian War, he had failed in one skirmish to keep his Native American allies from killing a surrendering French envoy. This haunted him, and loyalist critics and some British commentators throughout the American Revolutionary War would point out that he had lapsed. But so he was certainly going to lead his new army in the American Revolutionary War by the power of example, and let his army set the example for European allies towards their British opponents, and to showcase that the American forces would grant quarter when a British enemy surrendered and then treat their prisoners of war, at least by these minimal agreed standards. By and large, that works out. Mm. It is easier. So if you look at the territory that the Americans can spread British and German prisoner populations across, they can use more space, disperse the populations, reduce the impact of contagious diseases. They also experiment, very interestingly, with a prisoner laborer scheme. Mm. This is mostly for German soldiers, not so much the British, but they will farm out German soldiers to local farmers and businesses, in some cases even found factories, in some cases even to produce munitions for the Continental Army. And that, of course, means you've got one or two, maybe 10 prisoners in one place instead of 100 or 1,000. You can keep them in a more healthy condition. They are more likely to survive. You have much lower mortality rates. Yeah. So there's the example, there's the principle, and then, of course, there are both conditions and there are individual other lower-ranking officers who don't quite conform to the instructions from above. But by and large, if you look at the big picture, there's a significant difference there.
One of the really most brutal stories that you lay out about, we should say, American colonial atrocities, happens in 1779. Now, in the 1770s, as you point out in the book, most of North America, this, of course, is still Indian country. And there had been a lot of violent conflicts between these indigenous people and white settlers, of course. But in February of 1779, the United States Continental Congress agrees to launch this mission into Indian country. And here's what you write. You said, General Washington laid out the Continental Army's objective in the campaign against the Six Nations as nothing less than the total destruction and devastation of their settlements and the capture of as many prisoners of every age and sex as possible. Talk about how this plays out, because it is a really brutal story.
We tend to remember well the violence that Native Americans inflicted on white frontier settlements. We remember much less well that the violence flowed in both directions. So by halfway through the war, 1778, 1779, several of the frontier states, Pennsylvania, New York, demand action by the Congress, by the Continental Army, to stop Native American violent incursions into their settlements. That leads to that order by the Congress that you just cited. And fully one-third of the Continental Army in the summer of 1779 is deployed in the largest mission by far of that entire campaign season to move against the against Iroquois, the land of the Six Nations. Yeah. Like the vast majority of Native American nations, five of them had decided it would be in their better interest, if they had to take sides, to side with the British Empire rather than with the Americans. And so the Continental Army deploys. It is so large and so small, so slow moving, that most Native Americans move away, escape from their settlements well in advance of the arrival of the American army. The army, instead of fighting skirmishes and failing to take almost any prisoners, systematically destroys the life resources, if you want, the civilization, really, of the Native Americans. They burn and throw into rivers vast quantities of corn. They destroy the vegetable plantations, the orchards, and along the way, the houses and the council houses of the Native Americans. They will rifle their burial mounds, their graves. And to give your listeners a sense of the scale, about one-third of the target population, there were about 15,000 in the target population, about 5,000 flee that summer, mostly towards Niagara, a British garrison and fort. And of those, more than 1,000 Native American men, women, and children don't survive the following winter as a result of starvation, the cold, diseases. And that is, again, to put it in perspective, the equivalent of 15% of the entire battlefield deaths suffered by the Continental Army throughout the entire war. The symbolism of the attack, so this is basically an extreme version of what's called often the feed fight. Washington knew that the previous 2 years' crops had failed and that his attack was being launched at a time too late to replant a new crop. He was systematically aiming for the starvation, for the destruction of the population. There are other dimensions to this campaign. The Continental Army is accompanied by surveyors. The diaries and the journals of the officers and even some soldiers on the campaign note the quality of the land, of the water resources. And after the campaign is over, several of the participating officers come back to look at land prospects. George Washington himself, before the war is yet fully over, in 1783, undertakes a prospecting tour. He comes back and he boasts he has just acquired 6,000 amazingly cheap acres at Oriskany, along with the governor of New York, George Clinton. So there is a land-grabbing agenda to this, which means the Continental Army, which, when it looks east, is fighting a war against an oppressive empire, is at the same time forging the path for a new American empire when looking west and displacing the indigenous populations. And then there is the very macabre aftermath in a museum in Philadelphia by the end of the war. Polite, colonial, now independent American visitors can look at not just goods rifled from material items rifled from Native American burial mounds, but also body parts taken during that campaign.
I want to ask you about rape, which is, there are various stories, of course, that play out. This is related to the violence here. It was a crime the British punished by death, but rape in war, it seems, under the laws of war, it seemed different. The British, you say, didn't officially endorse rape as an act of violence, a strategic act of violence, I suppose. But you said there was a tolerance for it across the divisions of rank and class. But this is a hard one to, I guess this is a hard one to document, because you say it's impossible, really, to quantify just how many rapes occurred during the Revolutionary War.
That's right. As in most, if not all wars, women in particular were exposed to significant risk of sexual violence and rape. The British Army posed the main risk, but there are also cases of American soldiers, both loyalist and even patriot, committing acts of sexual violence against American women. Mm. The British Army did indeed tolerate sexual violence to a significant degree. We know from courts-martial about
large numbers of instances of rape, not just of civilian women of an enemy population in enemy territory, but also of women and often girls as young as 4, 6, or 7 years old, who were amongst the so-called camp followers, those large populations who kept an 18th century army running and alive and their clothes washed and soldiers fed and their uniforms mended and so on. I tell the story of Abigail Palmer, a 13-year-old American girl who is in the house of her grandfather, a farmer in Hunterdon County, New Jersey, along with two teenage friends and an aunt of hers who is pregnant at the time and the grandfather. Some British soldiers, not targeting this house because its inhabitants are known to be patriots, rebels, or helping the American war effort, but apparently just randomly, targets of opportunity. British soldiers seize control of the residence, and over 3 successive days rape Abigail and her teenage friends and that pregnant aunt. Grandfather tries to intervene and is threatened to be killed if he doesn't stand back. And on the 3rd day, the British soldiers take 2 of the girls away to their nearby army camp, where the girls undergo further gang rapes for another day and another night before they are released. We know about this story. We know about Abigail, who otherwise I have not been able to find in the historical documentation. And we know about similar instances of rape, both in that region and then in other parts of the war zone across the war, because some, like Abigail, bravely gave testimony. They responded to the Continental Congress's request through investigative commissions to document British war crimes. So, you know, these days we're sadly used to war crimes tribunals, truth and reconciliation commissions, and so on. The patriots, the revolutionary leaders, were innovators, very creative and quite relentless in documenting British war crimes, whether it was battlefield atrocities or prison abuses we talked about, or whether it was the raping of American civilian women. And so they would send out legal officials or army officials or medical doctors, whoever was available in the region of the reported or rumored war crime, and document, seeking eyewitness testimony, statements, sometimes orderly books, any material evidence. And in this case, Abigail and one of her friends and the aunt gave testimony in response to the American investigators. They signed with their mark, and then the investigators sent their reports back to the Congress. The Congress would put them together in a bigger report and publish all these testimonies word by word, but with the names taken out, so anonymized, to protect the identity of the victims, and then widely disseminate these reports through the newspapers across not just the 13 colonies, but also Europe, France, Britain, what is now the Netherlands, indeed the Caribbean, making the case that even a battlefield defeat, even the setback, the temporary setback, and certainly the violation of American women, was testimony to the British oppression and the moral inferiority of the British Empire, which could never again be allowed to rule over any part of America. So, you know, whether it is a mangled soldier's body or whether it is a destroyed settlement or whether it is an American woman's sexually violated body, the Patriot leaders would turn them into tools in their moral, their polemical, if you want, their propaganda war. And so, you know, what I wanted the reader to take away about the rape scene is that to do justice to this horrific topic in the revolution, we need to recognize both the harrowing ordeal of the individual assaulted women and the fact also that the political authorities used these assaults as a tool in the propaganda war.
Turn them into moral assets for the cause.
That's right.
Yeah. Holger Hoek, his book is Scars of Independence, America's Violent Birth. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. ¶¶ This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with historian Holger Hoek. We're talking about his book, Scars of Independence, America's Violent Birth. There's a story that really, in some ways, is kind of a central tale in the book, and it plays out in September of 1778. This has come to be known. Well, it has various names. The Baylor Massacre is one, and the British had come upon this elite light cavalry unit of the Continental Army. These were dragoons, soldiers. And the plan, as it plays out, and I want to have you talk about this, was not to shoot these men, but to attack them and kill them with bayonets. So let's start with getting the characters straight here, one of them anyway. The general in charge for this, the British, is Charles Grey. And you say that Grey's men, being willing to follow him in this plan, and the plan was to attack them at night, in the very middle of the night, to follow him in a night operation with only bayonets. He said, we'll only use bayonets. Really spoke to his reputation as a leader. Talk about this this attack, if you would.
Charles Grey had earned his military spurs in another rebellion of the Scots Highlanders, that is, 30 years earlier, against the British Crown. As had some other leaders in fighting in the American War. Grey indeed instructed his soldiers to remove the flints, to use only bayonets. There were some practical reasons for this, to preserve the element of surprise, to eliminate the risk of friendly fire at nighttime in the confusion of a nighttime attack. But really, he played also to psychological advantage. Grey, like other British military leaders, knew all too well that their American counterparts were intensely horrified of the bayonet. I think this is largely to do with the fact that American soldiers were less accustomed to fighting with the bayonet. So they had a particular horror of that weapon. Sometimes at the time it was compared to British soldiers' horror of the Native American tomahawk, just a weapon that you were not used to.
It's a socket bayonet, which you
socket bayonet, yeah. A blade 13 to 15 inches long stuck at the top of the musket and plunged with aggression into the enemy body, tearing apart everything in its way, muscles, arteries, organs, especially also on the way out. The attack happens the dead of night, several hundred British soldiers encircling the 106 American light dragoons sleeping in six barns. The British overcome the perimeter defenses without being noticed. They take the headquarters of the American officers, again by surprise. No one can warn the soldiers in the barns. And by the time those soldiers realize they're being surrounded, they intend to surrender. They stumble, just awoken out of their sleep by the stomping of the boots and the yelling of the British soldiers screaming as they run towards their barns. The Americans stumble out of the barns and seek to surrender. But instead, they begin to be bayoneted. And this happens one barn after the next without the next set of targets quite realizing for the first 10, 15 minutes of this attack what is actually happening. At some point, and we know this again from investigations afterwards, at some point, American soldiers, as they try to surrender, observe that there is some hesitation on the part of their British assailants. They ask for instructions to be repeated. They seek renewed orders. Are they really supposed to kill in cold blood their surrendering enemy, who is appealing in their own language for mercy and praying to the same God? And the orders come back, yes, kill all of them. And so it's one of the largest scale atrocities, battlefield atrocities, on the part of the British in the entire war. Some escape by pretending that they're dead and then crawling off into a thicket or plunging into a stream nearby when the British are not looking. And some are left behind severely wounded. Again, this makes for a good victim's narrative on the part of the Patriots. So a report, again, is written up with the eyewitness testimony and, crucially, a forensically detailed examination of the bodies of both dead and surviving American soldiers. Medical personnel, army officers on site are counting and describing the number and the specific nature of the wounds in an effort to demonstrate that someone was not killed
in the act of defending themselves, not in hot blood, but in cold blood, trying to surrender, already defenseless, and suffering a dozen or 16 stab wounds to various parts of their body, including the back.
Let's talk about the aftermath of all of this, because we established this identity as Americans in part on what we told ourselves about the war, you say in the book, that we had always been humane, that the British soldiers had not. Basically, you say, over time came to scrub the true role that we played in the war. And you quote, you use a speech from 1815 where the speaker said that the Americans had acted untarnished with a single blood speck of inhumanity, that, you know, we had conducted ourselves with dignified moderation worthy of our cause. What happens? We scrub and scrub and rework and rework, and where is the story today now?
The scrubbing occurs, as you say, on all sides. So yep. Immediately after the war, the American patriots, typical case of winners getting to tell the story, the American patriots scrub certainly the American-on-American violence, the violence the patriots had committed against the American loyalists, out of the story. And the loyalists, as the cost of their reintegration into the new American nation, have to bear their own wounds and scars quietly. They do not tell a story of victimhood. They do not, if you want, engage in a sort of melancholy folklore of loss the way that American Southerners would after the Civil War, in my counting, the Second American Civil War. The British, at the same time, have little interest in dwelling on the greatest imperial disaster to date. And so as late as the centenary of the end of the Revolution in 1883, the Cambridge historian of the British Empire, Sir John Seeley, would say that we consider the American Revolution as an embarrassing episode that we try to mention as seldom as we can. And then by the turn of the 20th century, with changing geostrategic circumstances, as the American and the British forge a new and special relationship, any violence between what are now considered similar, you know, linked Anglo-Saxon cultures and nations is very inconvenient and gets further scrubbed out of the record. I think fast-forwarding today, it still seems to me a lot of Americans cling on to their last great romance with war, this American Revolutionary War, because we live in these difficult times of worldwide conflicts, revolutions, civil wars, genocide, terror. But I would turn this around and I'd say it's precisely because we live in these times and we have to deal with civil conflicts, with stalled revolutions, with failed states, that Americans should re-engage with their own tumultuous birth, if only to see the connection between nation building and violence, to see the contradictory legacies of the American founding, the pitfalls, if you want, of pursuing a moral objective with violent means, but also to see that the founders, in fact, led with the power of example, as much as the example of American power as a foreign policy principle. We were talking about George Washington earlier. In 1785, one of the earliest treaties the now independent United States of America forged with a foreign power is a treaty of friendship and commerce with the Kingdom of Prussia. And the Americans, led by Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin, insist on writing into that treaty a clause for the protection of prisoners of war in future conflicts. The sorts of things no one must do and the sorts of things everyone must do to protect them, minimum standards for treatment. When we had the debates under George W. Bush's presidency about extraordinary rendition and enhanced interrogation of unlawful combatants, you might remember there were critics both within the U.S. Congress and outside who kept quoting George Washington to remind the nation of the importance of upholding core values, including, indeed, especially in times of war and conflict.
Let me ask you this finally. What have you noticed in the reaction to the book here in the United States? Americans hearing the story of this brutal violence, sometimes engaged in by their American patriot heroes. I wonder if, do you think we're mature enough as a country to have this, as you put it, this reappraisal of our beginnings, which is what you're hoping for?
I would certainly hope so. Now that we're in a moment where we see extreme political polarization and the demonization of the political enemy, the use of violence again as a means of politics, the intimidation of the press, all elements that remind us immediately of the founding moment. When we see the ongoing discrimination against African Americans in the justice system, in terms of voting rights, in police conduct, we're reminded that the whitewashing of the violence of race and of slavery and the violence against African American slaves in the revolution, just as the whitewashing of the violence against Native Americans that we talked about has maybe led to an overemphasis on progressive forces in U.S. history, and it is urgent that we re-engage with this long, difficult, harrowing trajectory. So, as a historian, I hope that, you know, would-be tyrants, Timothy Snyder, the Yale historian, has written, want us to forget our history. And instead, what we want to do, I think, is to remember our history, to listen for echoes, and allow it to inform our decision-making going forward.
It's Holger Hoek. He's an historian at the University of Pittsburgh. His book is Scars of Independence, America's Violent Birth. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.